I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we'll be exploring the long history of the fight for racial justice at Duke University. Duke came under scrutiny during the Trump era in the United States due to Richard Spencer, a founding purveyor of the alt-right, and Stephen Miller, an advisor for President Donald Trump, being Duke alumni. The story of Duke University and race relations, its struggles with racial justice, go back much further, however. Joining us on this edition of the program to tell us that story is Theodore D. Siegel, author of the new book, Point of Reckoning, The Fight for Racial Justice at Duke University. What can the struggles for racial justice at Duke University, culminating in the takeover of the Allen Building in 1969, tell us about struggles today? Hopefully, you may glean some answers to that question in the following conversation. And now, on to the discussion with Theodore D. Siegel, author of Point of Reckoning, The Fight for Racial Justice at Duke University. Welcome to Parallax Views, Ted Siegel, author of the fascinating new book, Point of Reckoning, The Fight for Racial Justice at Duke University. We've been trying to get this interview off the ground for a while, and finally we were able to make it happen. So how are you doing today, Ted?
I'm doing just great and happy we can connect and very pleased to be on your show.
So before we get into the main subject of your book, Point of Reckoning, for my listeners that may be unfamiliar, you're sort of a new voice to the show, first time guest, could you give a little bit of background about yourself?
I will, and actually that background relates to the book, and so I'll just summarize it this way. So I was, in 1979, a history graduate student at Duke University and started a master's thesis I never finished on Black student activism at Duke in the 60s. I ended up leaving graduate school. I had this wonderful 35-year-long career as a lawyer here in Washington, D.C. And just as I was getting ready to retire, I got the idea, really for no particular reason, that it would be fun, now that I was retiring from my law practice, to go back and revisit and finish the master's thesis that I had started 40 years earlier. And so I went back, pulled the box of documents out of our basement, and began to sort of reinvestigate the topic. And by virtue of having had the 40 years of life experience, I saw it very differently. I got into it much, much more deeply. I was able to attract at Duke history professors and the archivist to really become very interested in the project. And what ended up as an anticipated month or 2 month project, finishing this master's thesis turned into over 4 years and resulted in Point of Reckoning, which is the book we're talking about today.
If you could, for my listeners, could you give us a little background about the history of Duke University leading up to the protests of the civil rights era? Because I think Duke has a long history when it comes to these issues.
Yes. So Duke traces its origins to the mid-1800s, Brown's schoolhouse, which became a college. Ultimately, that college became named Trinity College, thanks to the largesse of the Duke family. Trinity College, which was somewhere in rural North Carolina, ended up moving to Durham. And in 1924, James B. Duke, who had made a fortune in the tobacco industry and the power industry and the textile industry, decided that he wanted to combine his business interests with his philanthropic interests. And one of the things he did was to endow Trinity College with what was then a massive amount of money on the condition that Trinity College would change its name to Duke University. And so Duke, kind of uniquely among many colleges and universities, kind of sprang into existence in one fell swoop. Duke gave his millions, which today would be billions, and the campus went up, and it immediately became a strong regional university, but its ambitions were always to become a significant national university. And so from the 1924, when Trinity became Duke, until 1963, when it was desegregated, Duke was what is called, I'm sure you know, a historically white college or university, an HWCU. And what that means is that throughout this period, Duke was a school that was built by white people for the benefit of white people. There were no Black students, there was no Black faculty, there was no one Black in administration. The only workers on the Duke campus who were Black were service workers who, groundskeepers and janitors and maids and help in the food hall. So Duke was this school where every choice, every design choice, every architectural decision, every course selection, every course development, food in the dining hall, design choices in the library, what books go in the library. As a HWCU for Duke and for these other HWCUs, those decisions were made, again, by white people for the benefit of a white student body, faculty, and administration. And during this period, Duke honored all of the rules and regulations and customs of the Jim Crow South in higher education. In addition to having no Black people other than in service capacities, the movie theater on campus had segregated seating. The golf course didn't allow Black players. The football and basketball teams obviously were all white because there were no Black students. The morgue in Duke Hospital separated bodies by Black, white, male, and female. There were Black and white water fountains and Black and white bathrooms. And so it was just a complete picture of segregation, and that is the world that Duke inhabited until 1963, when the undergraduate school desegregated.
It's interesting. Something I noted while reading Point of Reckoning was that you frame the sort of desegregation of Duke in terms of the word encounters. I was just interested why that term encounters. Maybe we can delve into that a little bit.
Yeah, that's a terrific question, and it goes to the core of the story I'm trying to tell in the book. So in the segregated Jim Crow South, as everyone would know, blacks and whites lived in separate worlds. Whites, to the extent they knew any black people, they were almost certainly people helping them in a service capacity. They had no black colleagues, they had no black friends. And so you had this white world. And then, mostly out of the view of these white people, you had these black communities, which again suffered under segregation, but otherwise were wonderfully supportive, wonderfully warm, wonderfully rich. They were communities where these extraordinary youngsters who ended up desegregating Duke, between family and church and school, everything the community had was poured into them. The schools, although they were underfunded, were quite excellent. Teachers made accommodations to be able to teach advanced courses, even though the law at the time prohibited that. At one school I studied, every teacher was required to visit every family of every student before the school year started, so that there would be this kind of holistic approach to the development of these youngsters. So what you ended up with were these remarkable, smart, trained, high-achieving youngsters who were living in these very warm and comfortable communities. And then in 1962, the Board of Trustees of Duke decided to desegregate the undergraduate school. And so when these black students, initially only five in number, ended up on the Duke campus, it was the first time that these black students had really encountered white people in any material capacity. And it was the first time that the white people at Duke had ever needed to deal with or figure out how to talk to or figure out how to work with black people, other than, again, in a service capacity at the golf club or at the just wherever, the dining hall. And so this encounter, this moment where these two groups that had been segregated come together, JG, that is the encounter that kicks off my story. And by starting the story at that moment, because it's a first encounter and because almost as a thought exercise, one could imagine this encounter working out in a bunch of different ways, it's a perfect prism through which to see how the racial attitudes of the white people at Duke informed their perception of and their treatment of these remarkable new black students. So it's a first encounter. I call it a historic encounter, but it's really two groups that had never attempted to relate to one another in a kind of as equals previously.
I want to talk a little bit about that first class, that sort of chosen few who made up the first class of black students attending Duke University. But first, just to set some groundwork for my younger listeners, what was happening in the South during the time of desegregation at Duke? What was happening around the country, and how was Duke University handling it? How were these white students at Duke University handling it? And how were these first black students at Duke University handling it? I know that that's a complex question, but it's a lot to unpack, but I hope we can delve into that.
No, it's a great question. So the civil rights movement had begun in earnest earlier, but was really bursting into public view nationwide in the early 60s with Martin Luther King and other Black leaders directing it. The movement was causing changes to occur, making the world of segregation and Jim Crow at Duke and elsewhere in the South much more visible. And so both the federal government as well as big foundation funders like the Ford Foundation began to make it known to segregated institutions that they were going to lose their government or foundation funding unless they made the move to desegregate. So when Duke desegregated, it wasn't because it was the right thing to do. It wasn't on moral grounds, although many people saw it as the moral thing to do. It's absolutely clear that the reason Duke desegregated was because maintaining its segregationist admissions policy was going to cut off this money and block Duke's ascent from being a strong regional school into becoming the national university that Duke, as far back as 1924, envisioned. So the white students at Duke had mixed attitudes. I mean, when there were polls among students taken by the student newspaper, desegregation would win like 60-40 or 70-30. It's not like there was a unanimity of opinion among Duke students that desegregation was the right thing to do. But certain groups, the campus Methodist groups and certain members of various departments, were more active in the civil rights movement, participated in sit-ins that were occurring in Durham and nearby in Chapel Hill. And so they began to push from within for this decision to occur. So it's a very, very dynamic time. You've got the civil rights movement, you've got the federal government, you've got these funders, you've got the culture changing and its attitudes toward race. And here you've got Duke basically forced to admit Black undergraduates for the first time.
Also, I considered this worth asking, was there any difference when it came to these white students, maybe with regards to gender? Did women handle things differently than men? Men handle things differently than women when it came to this experience of this historic first encounter?
It's just a great question. So back in this period, in the late 50s, early 60s, for whatever reason, women at Duke were of a higher academic caliber than the men. The men, it was kind of a country club school. Maids cleaned the men's dorm rooms all the way up until 1968. And so it was a place, a lot of legacy admits, a lot of students that were there just, you know, for the academics, but also for the social world. The women at Duke in this period were sharper and more academic and certainly higher achieving in their academics at Duke. And whether for that reason or for some other reason, throughout my story, the women act more, are much more forward-leaning and much more progressive in their attitudes toward race than the men were. I didn't kind of dig into the details of why exactly that was, but as protests began to emerge and as change began to occur on the Duke campus, the women were much quicker to support these activities than the men were. Not to say that there weren't many men who supported them, but the women were better students and more actively involved in the racial issues on campus than the men were.
Generally speaking, maybe we could say that the Mill students were more, simply put, conservative. And I don't even just mean politically, but just generally maybe more conservative, more not as forward thinking.
Yes. I mean, I think that's well put. And I think that is accurate for sure. Yep. I think that's exactly right.
So in regards to these first Black students attending Duke University, is there anything we should add just to give further context for listeners about them, any details that you have about them that may paint a picture for my audience?
Well, as I mentioned, these kids came out of these really remarkable, very, very close-knit segregated Black communities. Within the Black community, from the moment of emancipation forward, the primary value was on getting an education. The freedmen would do anything if it gave them the opportunity for themselves or for their kids to get an education. So education was just a defining value and impulse within the Black community against tremendous, tremendous obstacles and odds. And so these kids came from families who put a tremendous premium on education because they viewed education as the vehicle through which not only their kids, but the Black race generally would achieve, you know, what was called uplift. It was a way of kind of advancing the race if these kids could kind of proceed. And so they came from communities that just put a premium on education. They came with the burden of tremendous community expectations. These students, many of them would have preferred to go to historically Black colleges and universities because they knew they would fit in. That's where their friends were going. It was a much more comfortable pick, but their parents had groomed them to be ready for this moment when the doors opened and that they could be at the vanguard of desegregation. And then the final thing I would say is, growing up, because these segregated communities were so isolated, there was very little day-to-day exposure to racism, because the population you're dealing with growing up is a Black community. And so the kids had limited exposure and experience with dealing with white people in general and dealing with racist acts toward them, because there had been very little personal experience of that in these communities they grew up in.
So how does Duke University prepare for the arrival of these students and this sort of historic encounter?
Well, that's where the story begins. And the answer to that question is they did absolutely or next to absolutely nothing to prepare. They did not, for example, do site visits to other schools that had recently desegregated because there were no Black faculty or administrators at Duke. They concluded that there was no one in the Black community to call on, even though Durham was full of very prominent Black businessmen and North Carolina College. They just had blinders on, and they essentially believed that by admitting these students, the university had taken an enormous step forward. And, you know, what more did they need to do? Their vision was that these students would come in, they would blend into the student body. One dean described it to me as a natural amalgamation. The students would just kind of fit into the student body. And the Duke president described it as saying to these students, come in, be white. They just anticipated that they would just slide right into this entirely white institution without significant difficulty. So they felt proud that they had made this step, but although they were educators with obligations to educate students in a way that would allow them to thrive, they did absolutely nothing to prepare themselves or Duke for this moment. And in fact, there were practices that were racist that persisted following desegregation because, again, little if any thought was given to what it meant to have Duke desegregated. So their racial attitudes informed how they perceived and failed to prepare for the arrival of these students.
It's interesting, I think, too, because, you know, for millennials and Generation Z, I think we consider things like distinct cultural differences or distinctive cultural mores and attitudes. It sounds like these things weren't really considered by Duke University when these first Black students arrived. In other words, there wasn't necessarily a lot of study into the distinctive cultural, social needs of these first Black students.
Precisely. There was essentially none of that. Because, again, the administrators thought these kids were just lucky to be there. The ones that were, quote, good enough would just fit in and succeed. The other ones wouldn't. And they saw no obligation whatsoever to try to understand what the distinctive needs and strengths these students might have and how best to create an environment for them that would allow them to thrive in the same way that white students had thrived at Duke for many decades. So you're precisely correct.
In regards to maybe entrenched racism and policies of racism, what were some of the entrenched policies at Duke University at the time leading up to the arrival of these students, and then maintained when the students arrived in 1963?
Well, the issue that became most visible and prominent on campus was the university's practice of holding off-campus university events at a segregated country club called Hope Valley Country Club. It truly did not occur in any material way to the men, predominantly men who ran Duke, that once you had Black undergraduates present on the campus, there would eventually become a problem if you allowed your campus groups to host events at segregated university facilities. So that's one example. Another is, you know, the playing of Dixie and display of the Confederate flag. Dixie was really treated as an anthem. The crowd at sporting events would stand to sing it. The Confederate flag would be displayed. And obviously for these students, that was very jarring. A lot of it, JG, was the attitudes of faculty and administrators at Duke. Students would be told by their deans to forget about pursuing a pre-med curriculum because they would never succeed at it anyway. Teachers would make overtly racist statements or make statements that, you know, would really put down in a very direct way Black students. It was just kind of across the board. There were fraternities and sororities had in their charters a prohibition on admitting Black students. So although they could participate in Rush, they were almost by definition not eligible to join these sororities. And so in pretty much every area of campus life, attitudes and policies, Jim Crow attitudes and policies persisted at Duke even once the students arrived. I mean, that's not to say that nothing happened when the students arrived. I mean, previously, dormitories had been segregated. So if a prior to desegregation, if a Black student or Black scholar was on the Duke campus for purpose of a let's say, a program, a community program, a summer program, or any kind of sort of educational reason, they were not permitted to stay overnight in the dorms. The dining halls were segregated. Prominent Black professor of theology, when he considered coming to Duke one summer for a program sponsored by the Divinity School, was told, well, you won't be able to eat in the dining halls, but we have a lot of snack bars that are kind of readily available. Duke had a block of land that it would parcel out to professors and others as an inducement to join the Duke community. And Duke continued to transfer those properties subject to a restrictive racial clause that prohibited the future sale of the property to any non-white person. Again, it just goes on and on, but other than the things that had to happen by definition, like dormitory desegregation and dining hall desegregation and swimming pool desegregation, other than those types of things, many of these policies and attitudes remained in place once the student arrived.
So how do these Black students who are just coming into Duke University, how do they first deal with some of this, I mean, just racist policy and maybe some of the attitudes of students who didn't have a progressive vision that maybe had, you know, very entrenched racist beliefs? I'm assuming this causes a lot of loneliness and isolation, and that a lot of the Black students really have to band together. I guess I'm wanting to get into the Afro-American society.
Sure. But just, you're exactly correct. I mean, initially there were so few Blacks at Duke, and Duke made the decision to spread the Black students out. They weren't together in one specific area. Duke has two campuses, West Campus for men, East Campus for girls, so that women, that created further separation. And so the existence of these students, for the most part, was one of tremendous loneliness, isolation, no one to talk to. Really, the only people that took these students under their wing were the Black service workers, the maids and janitors and the groundskeepers, who would have them to their home for dinner. But throughout the early 60s, really up until 1966, 1967, there was no sort of formal structure or organized way for Black students to be in community with one another.
And could you talk a little bit more about the formation of the Afro-American Society, or the AAS?
Yes. So the students from all over campus were having the same experiences and were feeling many of the same feelings of anger and alienation and disconnection, but not able to share it with each other. And so even in 1966 and before, some students were attempting to organize the Black students into some sort of group. By 1966, Afro-American societies were being formed on other campuses. But when the Black students who considered themselves leaders would approach these students, the students, who came from these very conservative families were extremely leery of getting into what looked to them like campus activism. They knew what a poor reaction they would receive from their parents. And so there was really no enthusiasm even for the Black students to meet together as a group. So in early 1967, Stokely Carmichael, the head of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, appeared on campus, and his talk, because it helped these students sort of understand their situation in a deeper way, caused them finally to meet as a group, caused them to form the Afro-American Society. But the Afro-American Society, when first established, it wasn't some political group looking to change Duke or change the world. It was really a social group allowing these students to compare notes and to get closer and to form a community just to help them cope with this racist environment they had been parachuted into.
Now, my next question, I want to backtrack just a second here, because I'm looking over my notes and I failed to mention to you a figure that I wanted to talk about briefly, and then we'll get into the Allen Building takeover. I guess I wanted to ask you about the figure of Douglas Knight, who was president of Duke University from January 1st, 1964 to June 30th, 1969. Could you tell my listeners a little bit about Douglas Knight?
Certainly, and he's certainly a central actor in the events that unfold in my book. I mean, Duke, again, in 1962-1963, had taken this big step to desegregate, and they thought that by virtue of that, they were on the precipice, without doing anything further on race, to kind of get this rocket boost to national prominence. So when the presidency of Duke became open in 1962, they conducted a search that included not only people from the region, but they probably viewed it as a feather in their cap to attract someone, from the North, because it was the Northern schools that they aspired to be just like. And so this man, Douglas Knight, he was a Yale-trained classics professor who at 32 became president of Lawrence College in Appleton, Wisconsin. He was by now 41, 42, and he was kind of the guy all schools wanted to attract when their presidencies became open. Knight was offered the presidencies of Cornell and Duke at about the same time. He chose Duke, and even though he had many wonderful qualities, he was erudite and he was passionate, and he certainly had a vision for Duke. He had none of the sort of cultural connections, no Southern sort of feel for the environment there. And so he ends up parachuting into this situation that is still extraordinarily volatile on race, without any of the skills really necessary to even begin to deal with the problems he would face. So he was a moderate, a progressive, who came to Duke hoping to lead it into the future, and instead found himself in the middle of a whole lot of activism and conflict that he was just not able to deal with effectively.
I'm glad you mentioned the term progressive, because even the progressive administrators in this story, even they end up resisting change, right? I mean, they sort of use arguments like, oh, well, you know, change has to be gradual. We need gradualism, pragmatism. Could you talk a little bit about the ways that administrators resisted change?
Well, the first sin was not planning for the arrival of these students and not getting to know them once they were present on campus. And that was just a universal response. Because the students were protesting, the administrators thought everything was just fine. And Duke was, again, fulfilling its moral obligation to allow the students to attend there. But because they never got to know these kids and how remarkable they were or what their needs were, their judgments about race were guided by the assumptions or racial attitudes that they had prior to desegregation. And so these progressives within the administration, they would announce their support for change, but largely were unwilling to expend any political capital or, frankly, economic capital to see racial change occur. And they didn't see it as their personal responsibility to proactively figure out this problem and make changes at the university to accommodate it. So universities are highly decentralized institutions. And in order to make change occur, you got to get the administration to agree, then the department chair, and then the department. Change is very, very difficult at any decentralized institution like a university. But again, their heart was not in it. They retained this belief that they were fulfilling their responsibility simply by letting these kids attend. They thought the kids were doing just fine. And again, it was this blindness to what the students' experience was and what their needs were that allowed them to continue to operate in this, you know, largely fictional bubble. They just had understandings of who these kids were and what they wanted that were based on their own racial attitudes, not on the lived experience of these kids who had arrived on campus.
So things really begin to heat up in the late 60s. Could you talk a little bit about the silent vigil and what happens after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. in April 1968?
Yeah. One of the reasons why Duke is such a wonderful place to kind of tell this story and examine these attitudes among administrators is that it had a almost entirely white student protest in April of 1968, followed by an entirely black student protest 10 months later. So you've got kind of a side-by-side case study where you can see how differently administrators reacted to white students protesting as opposed to black students. So the silent vigil occurred following the assassination of Martin Luther King. Students were very, very aggrieved by this event. They felt personal responsibility. They felt it was incumbent on Duke to make a gesture to show it kind of understood the magnitude of the racial problem in the country. And this wasn't just the handful of lefties on campus. The assassination of King touched a much broader group of students. And so initially there was a march to the president's house, and the president opened his door, saw these 250 essentially almost entirely white students. He invited them to come in his house so that he could speak to them, so that he could have a discussion. He wrote in his memoir, he wanted to be as close to them as possible when the difficult issues came up. And so rather than viewing these students who were now occupying his home as protesters or militants or activists, he deemed them guests and said that they were there with his permission, and even allowed the women there. There was still a requirement for women living in the dorm to sign out of their dorm to a specific place if they wanted to be out of the dorm overnight. And so he actually went so far as to give permission to women who were occupying his house to be to sign out of their dorms to the house so that they could participate in this sit-in and not violate university parietal rules. And so these students were allowed to stay in the president's house for 36 hours. Ultimately, through some wise jawboning by administration, the administrators knew many of these white kids because they had served on committees together, or the students had leadership posts, or the students, the white students, were simply recognizable. They were understandable by the white administrators. One activist described the sit-in students as like the administrators' son and daughters. They felt a certain empathy with them, so they were allowed to stay. Ultimately, they were persuaded to decamp to the main quad of Duke University, where for 4 days and four nights, an increasing number of students joined what was a silent sit-in on the main quad. What started as a 250-person occupation of the president's house ended up 1,500 students sitting on the quad silently, other than when they were singing civil rights songs or whatever. And so you had this remarkable community that sprung up essentially overnight that white students were able to participate in, and that the university allowed to exist. They invited or called, required campus security and Durham police to come and make sure these students were safe, that reactionary fraternity members or members of the Duke community didn't hurt them. They were very, very deferential and supportive in many ways of the protest, even though in the end, the university was unwilling to take the kind of steps the students wanted to show its commitment to racial justice.
Could you talk a little bit about, after those 4 days, I guess the chairman of the Board of Trustees addresses the silent vigil. What happens with regards to that?
Yeah, I mean, when the chairman of the Board of Trustees, who was a man named Wright Tisdale, he was a general counsel of Ford Motor Company at the time. He was convinced that Duke administrators, Douglas Knight in particular, were way, way too soft on these administrators. And so when he heard that this kind of sit-in was forming on the Quad, he flew into Durham and basically took charge of decision-making. And his initial instinct was to just clear the Quad by any means necessary, shut down the school, suspend student leaders. And this is the path that may well have been taken, except for the fact that administrators, again, who knew these kids and were more empathetic to them, persuaded the board chair, that was not only, you know, politically untenable, but it was unnecessary and inappropriate because these kids were, you know, they were good kids. They were Duke's best students. They were Duke's most sincere students. So over the course of several days, they were able to actually, to some degree, turn Wright Tisdale around so that once the board had met and developed its response to the vigil, he agreed to go out and read the statement himself personally to this protest, which is a remarkable gesture given the point he was starting from. After he read the statement, the crowd broke into "We Shall Overcome," and although singing "We Shall Overcome" was the last thing this man wanted to do, he ended up sort of being corralled into singing "We Shall Overcome." And then that night,
it's very symbolically powerful that they sort of corralled him into joining in.
Absolutely. Symbolically powerful and very damaging to his career prospects back in Detroit when the picture of him doing that became a national story. So absolutely symbolically powerful. Yep. Totally correct.
But of course, there's sort of minimal concessions offered. He sort of had to be corralled into doing this. All is not necessarily just well and good after the silent vigil. What happens 10 months later? And I guess more importantly, what happens in between those 10 months? Because things are not necessarily going to calm down after this silent vigil.
Right. Right. Just as you said, the silent vigil ended pretty much in failure in terms of achieving its objectives. Its main objective was to allow the Black service workers at Duke to unionize, and Duke was never going to permit that in this era under this leadership. But the students then go back to their studies, the white students, and they move along, but in parallel, really. The Black students' activism is ramping up, and it's starting to come to a head. What the university did starting in the summer of 1968 was try to put together a committee. They finally caught up with the idea that if they were going to make the presence of these Black students work at the university, they were going to have to talk to them somehow, figure out what their problems were, and attempt to kind of negotiate out what changes the university would make. So starting in the summer of 68 and into the fall of 68, a series of negotiations were held between administrators, faculty members, and representatives of the Afro-American Society, where for the first time, the students presented. Initially, they were described as concerns to the university, but in the climate they were operating in, both on campus and nationally, they quickly sort of turned into demands. And this was sort of the singular opportunity that emerged for white administrators and faculty and Black students to talk to one another before the ultimate activist moment occurred in February of 1969.
Let's talk about that specific moment, and let's talk about the Well, simply put, the Allen Building takeover. Could you give my listeners some insight into that? And then I want to get into some of the first person accounts you got.
Yeah. So this will not surprise you, given the fact that there had been no communication between administrators and students from 1963 until the summer of 1968, Black students, that these negotiations did not go well, at least from the Black students' perspective. The administrators did make certain changes. They believed progress was being made, and they thought these committee meetings were productive. Sitting in the same meetings, because of the level of urgency and existential crisis the Black students were feeling about seeing their university make changes to allow them to thrive and to accommodate them, students saw the meetings as absolutely a complete dead end. Subcommittees of subcommittees, chairs of departments, you name it. And so they decided, having now had Black students at Duke for 6 years, and really just as a direct organic outgrowth of the problems they had been having, that they wanted to force the university to have a definitive discussion of their concerns. And the way they were going to do that was by occupying the bursar's office and the registrar's office in Duke's main administration building.
Real quick, now, this is after, you know, the administration has sort of been saying, we have to go through the proper channels, and they're sort of not listening.
Correct. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. The students perceive them as not listening, where administrators, if they're going through the motions of the proper channels, feel like they're acting in good faith to address the students' concerns. So there was just this complete fissure in how the progress of these discussions and the university's responsiveness was perceived.
And the Allen Building takeover, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I wanted to get that in there,
though. No. So the Allen Building takeover, first of all, it's important to note that this was not a decision that was made lightly by the students. There are a series of meetings, a lot of crying, a lot of debate. This was a step that was extraordinarily difficult for many of these students to undertake, because again, they came from families that were activists, but certainly had no intention of sending their children to Duke to be in harm's way in some direct action protest. But they decide as a group to do this occupation to force the university to respond. And so at precisely 8 a.m. on the morning of February 13th, 1969, a U-Haul truck pulled up outside the Allen Building. The back of it came down. These Black students who had staked out the Allen Building had figured out exactly where the doors were, what areas needed to be closed off. They had it all mapped out. They ran into the building and they took over. They occupied these suite of offices, the bursar and the registrar, and renamed that part of Duke University the Malcolm X Liberation School. And then they issued their demands, and they said, initially, they would not leave until their demands were met. And then they said they just simply wanted to begin negotiating, but neither of those things happened as the day went on.
I want to get into that. What were some of the injustices and hypocrisies that occurred when it came to how this takeover was handled by Duke University?
Well, again, the easiest way to see this, JG, is by comparing it to the silent vigil on the main quad and the occupation of the president's house that preceded it. Unlike The white students who, again, were called guests when they occupied the president's house and were treated with kid gloves as they sat out on the quad, essentially shutting down the university. It took a group of about 25 administrators who began meeting in the upper floors of the occupied Allen building. It took them about 1 hour to decide that the Black students inside Allen building would be given an ultimatum to leave. And if they didn't leave within an hour of the time they were given the ultimatum, force would be brought to bear to extricate them. None of the administrators knew any of these students. Again, this legacy of this initial failure to welcome these students into the university and get to know them. It's a straight line to this moment where students are occupying the first floor, administrators are meeting on the second floor. The administrators immediately consider these kids trespassers, and the wheels go in motion to cause this sort of climactic confrontation to occur later in the day.
What comes out of this confrontation? And then before we wrap up, I wanted to get into some of the first person accounts you were able to obtain from various players within this overarching story you tell. But first, what's the sort of fallout from the Allen building takeover?
Well, the fallout was that the students were able ultimately to leave. They left voluntarily. There was then a police riot on the quad that the Black students were away and safe. The white students got into it with the police on the quad. And there were committees formed, there were statements of support taken, there were statements of resolve taken. But again, consistent with how it had worked in the past and how it would work in the future, once the focus of the crisis, once the urgency of the activism dissipated, the attention of the university dissipated. And little was accomplished in terms of meeting these students' concerns. Many of those concerns are the same ones that Black students at Duke, you know, articulate today. So there were statements of support, but ultimately there was very little follow through.
Before closing out, the last two things I wanted to cover. First, what stood out to you in regards to first-person accounts when you were revisiting this story that you tell in Point of Reckoning? And I'm not just talking about the Allen building, but just the whole story of Point of Reckoning. You went through a lot of interviews and did a lot of research. What really stood out most for you in talking with various people?
Well, it's again, this relates back to my story, but again, when I first encountered this story, I was 23 years old. I was in graduate school. I had not really led my life to any degree. I viewed these participants in this these events when I studied them as a youngster as abstractions. I looked at the Black students almost as Black student action figures. I saw the administrators as these racists, and I just simply was unable to kind of connect with the humanity in all of the groups. And so when I went back as a parent and as someone who had spent decades in my own historically white institution of a law firm, I was able, when I would conduct interviews, and also when I read interviews that I had conducted in 1979, I was much more able to connect with the humanity of these people and the conflicts they were facing than I certainly was when I was a youngster doing this. So, just as a white person writing the story of the Black campus movement at Duke, in order to properly tell that story, at a minimum, you need to tell it in the voice of the people who participated. So I was very, very adamant that the narrative be play out with the actors and their statements driving the narrative without a lot of sort of observations or theorizing on my part. But it definitely humanized it and allowed me, I think, to connect much better with the Black student story than I otherwise would have been able to.
Now, the last thing I wanted to cover, and I know I've kept you a little bit over time here, so
no problem.
Very appreciative of that. I think the shadow of racism haunts both America and more specifically Duke. I mean, I think a lot of this came back up to the surface in people's minds, especially with the rise of President Donald Trump. People were looking at figures like Richard Spencer and Stephen Miller, who were Duke alums. And I think I heard a lot of rumbling about the Allen Building since the rise of Trump. There's been revisitations of it, I think.
Correct.
So in regards to today, what would you say about the continued struggle for racial justice at Duke University? Because not all the problems have been solved.
Not at all. And in fact, in the aftermath of the Black Lives Matter protests in the summer, Duke, like many other colleges and universities, announced its anti-racism initiative, which the president described as bold and expansive, and he'll get reports every month and really, you know, kind of like this time we really mean it. You know, he's using language very reminiscent of what administrators were saying in 1969, but he sincerely was attempting to launch this anti-racism initiative at Duke. But again, the original problem, this failure of white administrators to understand the lived experience of the Black students on their campus, their inability to kind of look at their own blinders and understand how it prevents them from seeing how these students are seeing things, that largely hasn't changed. And so students at Duke have the same or many of the same issues of not being heard, not being respected. There are racist incidents that occur. They feel the university isn't reacting quickly enough. There is still this gap, as there is in society, as there was in the law firm I worked on, between the pronouncements by the white administrators, their pronouncements of commitment, and their ability to really understand the nature of the problem, the nature of the people who are subject to the problem, and really to embrace what it's going to take for real change to occur. So the echoes of 69 reverberate today at Duke, and you know, there hasn't been any activism recently. There may not be in the future, but certainly the same issues are being dealt with that were not many of the same issues are being dealt with that were dealt with back in the 60s.
I just wanted to add to that. As I said, there's been focus on figures like Richard Spencer and Stephen Miller. What I think is really important about your book is you're looking at aspects of racism that are insidious in a different way, I think, than these really overt white nationalist figures like Richard Spencer. You're looking at maybe administrators that potentially have the best of intentions, but maybe they have sort of unconscious racism, or maybe they haven't done enough to try to understand the lived experiences of others. Could you comment a little bit on that aspect of the story in regards to the ways in which I think unconscious racism end up influencing us in ways that cause problems?
Yeah, there were at Duke, certainly in the period before desegregation on the board and in the faculty, lots of people who were overtly racist. They would say overtly racist things, and, you know, they're easy to understand, or they're easier to understand because, you know, you kind of know where they're coming from. But then there's this vast group that are impediments to change, not because they consciously oppose racial progress. In fact, they, if you ask them, would say they are in favor of it. But they are unwilling or unable to come to terms with what it would really require for the university to become, in the nomenclature of today, anti-racist. In other words, they, I think, believe that everything can remain the same, and then the university becomes anti-racist because people have read the right books and they've had the right discussions. And that's really not how it would need to work. I mean, the ultimate story of my book is that diversity and inclusion was never a core value of Duke in the 60s. It was never a value that the university was willing to fight for, spend for, really take steps to honor. And although even more than in the 60s, diversity and inclusion are stated as core values of Duke, it remains unclear whether this vast group of people who say they're in favor of progress are really going to be able to sort of understand why that progress is necessary and what it's going to take of the institution in order to achieve it. So you're right. I mean, that was really the revelation to me, JG. And frankly, again, I was 35 years in law firms, and I was on all the diversity committees, and I was the guy who was making the statements about the need for racial progress, but really accepting just simply sitting on a committee and saying, well, pat me on the back, I'm taking time to sit on the diversity committee. But it's people like me in the law firm and people like that in the university that are ultimately the reasons things don't change. They don't embrace racial change as a core value worth fighting for.
I think one of the big takeaways from this book as well isn't just that leaders need to really make a commitment to these causes if change is to happen, but also there needs to be sustained external pressure applied to institutions in order to get them to address issues like racial justice.
Yeah, my expertise is on the 6 years at Duke that is the focus of my story, but I know everything there is about to know about race at Duke, and I know a bit about how events played out at other schools, and it's hard to find instances of racial progress of any material type in the absence of some form of activism, some form of pressure on the institution to change. Certainly that has never, even with activism, Duke has resisted change. So in the absence of activism, JG, just what you said, there's really no context in which these people who lead Duke are going to, again, it's, some of it is resource allocation. The pie is only 100%. And if you've got, you know, a bunch of programs that you think are the right programs for your student body. And Black students or Brown students or Asian students come to you and say, you know, we want a new department, we want more faculty members. Those things cost money. And if the pie is only 100%, by definition, that means some money will need to be reallocated from the existing programs to the new programs with at least certain consequences on the constituencies for those old programs. And so, yeah, I mean, that's a very hard leap for these institutions to make. And again, they only have a shot of making it when they're kind of forced to do so.
Well, Ted Siegel, I want to thank you for joining us on Parallax Views. I hope my listeners have enjoyed and found this conversation rather insightful. I know that I did. For my listeners, how can they get a copy of Point of Reckoning, The Fight for Racial Justice at Duke University? And is there anything else you would like to add, any closing remarks or anything you really hope that listeners will get out of this book?
Well, you can get a copy of Point of Reckoning from Duke University Press or wherever books are sold. But I actually made the decision to make a PDF version of the book available via open access, meaning that in various archival repositories, including Duke's, a PDF version of the book is available to be downloaded and read on iPad or iPhone or whatever device you'd like. I really wanted to maximize the opportunity for people to read Point of Reckoning without regard to actually having to buy the book. But if you want to buy the book, you know, it's easy to find, and certainly Duke University Press would be happy to fix you up with one. You know, JG, I have to say, and I'm not just saying this to flatter you, that your questions were so insightful that I'm not sure what I would say in conclusion, because you've helped me cover the key points. I guess I would just say that my hope is that I did the story of the Black students and their Black student movement justice, and I hope my treatment of these administrators was done in a way that will allow people reading it now, to hopefully white people, to hopefully see some of themselves in these characters and hopefully reflect in a new way on, you know, how they're acting or not acting in the historically white institutions that so many of us continue to inhabit. So that's what I would say.
Well, again, I want to thank you, Ted Siegel, for coming on Parallax Views.
Well, thank you, JG, and I really appreciate it and enjoyed it.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Theodore D. Siegel, author of Point of Reckoning, The Fight for Racial Justice at Duke University. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.